going up.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices and give you a 5-year price guarantee on talk, text, and data. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Making financial decisions shouldn't feel like picking a TV show. Too many options, too much hype, and no way to know what's actually good. NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast cuts through the clutter. Their finance journalists break through real-world money decisions with clear, research-backed insights. From investing to home buying to credit cards, the nerds help you navigate major financial decisions with confidence. Leave TV to fate. Leave your next financial move to the nerds. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you listen.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to Jeffrey Wright and Company. My name is Jeffrey Wright. You can follow me on Twitter, on X, at JWright929ESPN. As always, you can listen on the radio dial, 92.9 FM or 680 AM. But if you're away from the radio and you want to stay up to date and you want to keep listening right here to 92.9 FM ESPN, download the Odyssey app. Free to download, free to listen. You can stream anytime, anywhere. You can even listen to all of our programming on demand. George Rocher is the producer of the program. Glad that he is with us. You can follow him on Twitter, on X, at KingGeorge94. George, good day, sir.
Happy Friday. I guess it's just ready to get to the weekend after this brutal week we've had.
Last night was quite the turn of events. Let's welcome to the program my company as he is each and every Tuesday and Friday. He's the host of VSiN Primetime. He's the host of VSiN's College Football, College Basketball Betting Podcast. Watch him on VSiN's Betting Tailgate shows on the weekends at 9 a.m. Central. Check local listings. You can always download the VSiN Watch app, I should say, on Twitter, on X, at one Tim Murray. Tim, good day, sir.
You know, I feel bad because I'm in a great mood. The NFL draft was very fruitful to your boy. And then I unfortunately had to watch the ending of that Grizzlies game in the sports book before leaving last night. And I said, ooh, it's probably not going to be a super joyous occasion.
All right. I don't know if I'm talking to the right man, because this is a man, let's not forget, that bet against his country in the Four Nations Cup.
Did I win money?
Correct, but you bet against America. You shorted the market, if you will.
Happiness hedge.
I need to be totally forthcoming with the audience. When Ja Morant got hurt, I immediately went and took Oklahoma City plus 13.5. I maxed it out. And then when the third quarter started and you could tell they could not handle the basketball, they being the Grizzlies, I took Oklahoma City plus 235. And let's just say my wife and I will be going to dinner on vacation based on the end result. Am I a bad person?
No.
No.
Not at all. I mean, I think I honestly think betting against your favorite team sometimes is the best bet you can make. In this
the emotional
regard.
Hedge?
Well, it's the emotional hedge, and you also know them better than other teams, right? You know you anticipated the injury.
I have seen that game played out.
Sure.
I've watched 82, whatever, now I guess at this point. So, George, we watched 83 plus. So I've seen 86. I've seen this team play 86 times this year.
Yeah, I don't think it makes you a bad person. Now, I wouldn't probably go around, you know, doing the Twitter thing that everybody seems to do, which is, hey,
put your winnings out there.
I hit this. Like, you know, I've got a buddy on there who I almost want to be like, dude, all right, relax, buddy. All right. Like, congrats on your win on whatever bet it is. But, you know, if Twitter, from a gambling standpoint, Twitter would be shutting down sportsbooks.
I would say this. If Twitter were an actual reflection, Vegas would not be building.
No, they would be shaking in their boots.
Correct. They would be sellers in the market.
Yeah, but no, I don't think it makes you a bad person to recognize a situation and to bet against it. And to be honest, when you took it at 13.5, you still could have been happy both ways, right? They could have won and still covered. Then you went on the money line, so that makes you a little less better of a person. But
well, I viewed it like this. It was a free roll. I was pretty convinced that if the Grizzlies were going to win, it was not going to be within 13 points. And so the way I looked at it was, all right, if I went Splitsville and they won, I would be happy. If my gut was correct, which it turned out to be, I will be able to go and take my wife to steak and seafood and not feel guilty about it.
There you go.
That was honestly the calculus in my head. Like, it honestly was less of an emotional hedge. It was more of like, I've just seen this play out. I'm gonna fire. But
so I gotta ask you, and I'm sure you'll get into the nuts and bolts and nooks and crannies of the game last night. Full disclosure, I was hosting a draft show until 8 p.m. Pacific.
You got screen 4. Congratulations.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
Yes.
So I wasn't fully locked in. I watched the final quarter at Circa and watched it melt away. What the hell was Zach Edey doing on that jump ball, by the way? That was like, dude, why are you stiff-arming Lou Dort in the head? Maybe it was just
I think, honestly, the only thing I could think of was, I don't know, George, I don't ever really pay that much attention to the tip-off. It was almost like he does it every time, like he couldn't believe that it was called. But, I mean, it was clearly a foul.
It was clearly a foul. I've done lots of jump balls in my life, and I don't recall that ever happening. Granted, I don't remember ever being, 9 inches taller than the person I was doing
right.
the jump
I,
ball
I honestly
against.
Think I think that might have actually played into it, because Dort's obviously an aggressive defender, and I think maybe it was just like instinct of like Dort decided, like, rather than trying to win the jump, he was almost like gonna jump into him.
Right, and I was wondering if it was like, was it a little frustration? Was like, just get off, like, get off of me.
Yeah, I think like it was like an instinct.
A fly,
yeah,
you know, not that. Once again, I was curious. I was like, what the hell?
It's not. I don't. I feel like I've watched as much sports as anyone that is my age. I think that was something I hadn't seen before.
I don't recall seeing that. I'm sure it has happened before, but I got to ask you before we kind of get into the specifics of the game, where. Because it's a series in which you talked about on Tuesday, and I don't think many people in Memphis were ultimately optimistic that they were going to win this series, and you lose the first game by 50-plus, second game you show a little bit of life. Like, does this rank highly in worst losses in Grizzlies history? Because, obviously, they went to a conference finals in 2013, swept by the Spurs, lose a game 7 to the Thunder back in 2011, go to the semifinals against the Warriors. Expectations were high, albeit with an injured roster in 23 against the Lakers. Like, it was painful, obviously, brutal, losing was it 26 or 29?
29. It was the Thunder's second biggest deficit of the season.
So, what does that mean? Just for you as a Grizzly fan and all our listeners, like, where does this rank? Or you're like, you were going to lose the series anyways. It sucked to lose a playoff game like this, but it was in big picture. Was it How painful was this game, I guess, is the question.
So to me, it's not in the top five because of what we've discussed, which is the stakes. If this felt like even despite the fact that I actually think what they were doing was taking the positives from game two in the second and third quarters, where they largely took care of the basketball. They figured out we cannot let the Thunder get set defensively, because if we try to play the half-court game with them, we got no shot. So it was just kind of first available shot. It wasn't really best shot. It was just first shot. And that was working. And obviously there's going to be some three-point variance because the Grizzlies were pretty hot in the first half. But even when it wasn't just the three-point shooting that was allowing them to have success, it was primarily cutting down on turnovers, not giving the Thunder just the easy layups and dunks off live ball turnovers, and it was not letting them get set. So you could talk yourself into, okay, this is repeatable. No one, I think, believed that all of a sudden the series is on, and hey, well, no one's lost home court yet, so no one was doing that. But I think for me, this can't rank anywhere above. They lost a game 7 at home to the Clippers that I was in the building, and it was one of those games that the box score is kind of misleading in that it seemed like it was a closer game than it was, but like from the very jump, it was on Mother's Day. I was working selling food, miserable, and I came home. I was selling food in North Carolina, just absolutely miserable. I came home for Mother's Day, and I told my mother I loved her so much, I'm going to game 7. And that one was brutal. There was also a Clippers series where the Grizzlies blew a 24-point fourth quarter lead. That one is up there. If you're going citywide, I mean, obviously the national championship game in 08 is going to be.
I was just talking yeah, Grizzlies.
In terms of the Grizzlies,
I mean, I got 08 national titles got me number one.
Yeah, okay. I don't think anything's
touching that.
I don't think anything can compare. While it wasn't as, like, I think the Spurs were gonna handle the Grizzlies in 2015 no matter what. In game three, the Grizzlies had a massive lead, and Pop did the hockey line switch where he was so pissed at all his starters, he just announced all five, like he sent them all at the same time, and they came back and they won that game in overtime. That one is up there. Personally, for me, game three of the 06 Mavericks series, the Grizzlies had never won a playoff game. They're up, I believe, 9 with about a minute 15 left. Maybe it was 8. And Dirk hits a 3 to send it to overtime. And it was, you knew when that game went to overtime that was going a certain way. That one is up there because while the stakes of the series weren't necessarily, were probably similar to this, it was still the chance to have your first playoff win. So I think the thing that's interesting about this game, to me, I'm a big believer of sports are supposed to be fun. And yes, I've made it a profession, but I inherently believe sports are supposed to be fun. It's supposed to be an escape. It's supposed to be something that we can watch greatness, but it doesn't need to be something that, you know, makes you feel worse about yourself. And obviously being a sports fan, like that's going to play into it. But what is so obvious to me right now is that the Grizzlies are decidedly not fun. And there's several reasons. And last night to me, like, is a microcosm of everything that you're going through. John Morant was playing unbelievably. And so much of the connection to the team is when you have a player like Ja Morant, it's just infectious. And we've had good teams, but we've never had someone like that. But in the back of your mind, you always go, what's going to happen? And you have this unbelievable game, and it's a reminder of, yeah, we can argue about whether or not we want to play the Thunder and get beat or get a draft pick. But it was like a reminder of playoff games can be very fun. And they used to be like the dates that you looked forward to on the calendar. Like the best times of the year here in Memphis are typically the playoffs, and then it rolls into, we have like a, we used to have a thing called Memphis in May where we had big, the music festival that rolls into Barbecue Fest. And like, those are big events for everyone on the calendar. And so like, you kind of associate the playoffs with Barbecue Fest, Music Fest, like it all kind of rolls in. Like, it's a good time of the year. It's not oppressively hot usually at this point. It's still a good time to go outside. And it was kind of a reminder of, oh yeah, this is what we used to look forward to. And then all of a sudden, Ja Morant gets hurt. And like, I think at this point, like, you have to be realistic. Like, Ja Morant is an undersized guard that plays a very, very vertical, physical style of play, and he misses a lot of games. And then when he goes out, you're sitting there going, do they have enough? And very quickly, you're reminded, hey, man, this team doesn't really have a backup point guard. With all due respect to Scottie Pippen Jr., who's a phenomenal story.
He was balling last night, too.
Yeah, he played well last night.
He was awesome.
That's for sure.
But he's not a point guard. He's a point guard only because he's not tall. And he's never been a point guard. He's always realistically been a two.
Yep.
And the Grizzlies could not handle the basketball. And this has been a problem for them when Ja's not out there. They've tried to do this no point guard offense, and Desmond Bain kind of becomes the de facto point guard. But they did not address a lack of a backup point guard, something that they haven't had since they let Tyus Jones go. And it rears its head. And then when you have a lead guard like Ja that you know realistically coming into the season, he's not going to play 82 of them. You didn't address it. You've got this weird situation with Jaren Jackson Jr. coming up where he's going to have a contract negotiation. And we'll still be waiting to see if he makes third-team All-NBA, in which that point he's Supermax eligible. Do you want to give him a Supermax? Like, what's the right number? Does he want to just make as much money as humanly possible? That's his right. I'm sure that's what his agent's going to want. Or do they come together and find a number? What if you can't find a number? Do you then have to decide, because you've only got him with 1 year left on the contract, is this the time that maybe you would move Jaren Jackson Jr.? Because if somebody got him before the season, they could have the bird rights. Like, that would be a value to them. They could sign him at a higher level. You have your three guys, but you've not surrounded them with anything else. And you just see when one guy goes down how just truly fragile it can be. And then on top of that, Tim, like, it's not something people want to talk about, but the Grizzlies and the city do not have a new lease. And negotiations on that are not going well. And they're trying to do a renovation, but the renovation that the Grizzlies largely wanted to do, because when FedEx Forum was built, the style of arena was outdated very, very quickly. And one of the big selling points. So if you look at the arenas that are similar, are the artist formerly known as Conseco Fieldhouse. If you like look at Conseco and the Forum in just the bowl, they're almost identical. What Quicken Loans, whatever Cleveland is, Ball Arena in Denver. But they were all built in the early part of the 2000s, and the big selling point was suites, suites, suites. And the Forum is, they have what they called courtside suites, where it was suites that were only like 18 rows from the floor. It was considered to be the big thing. Well, what started to happen was people started doing the math of, man, why am I buying this suite when I can buy four tickets like on the floor for half the price and enjoy it that way? And so the design quickly got outdated, and now the Grizzlies have this situation where about half of their seats are in the upper deck. And if you look at how every arena is basically getting built now of the new ones, basically what they're doing is these massive lower bowls, aka premium seating, and then a row of suites, maybe two on top of it, and then a small upper deck, because everyone realizes the money is in the quote unquote lower bowl. So what the Grizzlies would really like to do is flip is essentially flip the seating. They want to have more seats in the premium area and be up to date. Well, when they originally got the money, building costs were 3 times less than what they are. The pandemic just shot building costs through the roof. So when they originally got the money, the projections would show, yeah, you can probably do that renovation. Well, now you basically are just going to wind up with this underwhelming, I don't even know, like it's obviously going to be better than it is, but it's, you're not going to actually be able to accomplish the goal that you had set out to do. And then on top of that, downtown's going through it. And the Grizzlies, if they're going to make this their home, they want the neighborhood to be nice. And, you know, we can snap our fingers and say it should be so, but the reality is, Tim, like, when you look at who builds in Memphis, if you go and you look at the construction, it's all local people. There aren't New York firms coming in developing Memphis. There aren't San Francisco firms coming in and developing Memphis. And, you know, you can't just build. Like, you know what I mean? There's these people don't have that kind of money. And the area around downtown, like, I can't tell you another downtown I've been to that has this many vacant lots. And what last night is like a reminder of, it's like you can set aside all the problems and challenges, kind of feel good for a little bit, have a little bit of an escape, and then Ja Morant gets hurt, and then it makes you realize, oh, we're going to have to deal with all this. And not only is it, you're going to have to deal with it, you're going to have to deal with it, and you don't exactly have a great hand right now. I mean, I don't know if it's 2-7 offsuit, but let's just say the flop wasn't kind. And that's kind of where everyone is. And then on top of that, you know, the best part of being a fan, I think, is when you have the young team that shows promise and you can kind of imagine. Because really the results don't matter. Like, it's all about what could be. Well, now you've reached the point where these guys are not just hope and potential anymore. It's kind of go time. And now you're coming to the uncomfortable question of, are these three guys that you've thought about going to the highest of highs with, are they good enough? And right now the returns are coming back at best inconclusive. And then it becomes a question of, well, what can you do about it? The Grizzlies don't have a lot of financial flexibility in terms of cap space. And they don't have, like, a ton of assets that you could package into something else. And so as Ja Morant goes down, you spend the next half of the game watching this lead dwindle. And I've never seen the game clock move slower than it did last night, because let's be real, you were just trying to run out the clock. And then you're just left with, well, this is, you know, you're coming to the point where it's like you can avoid this situation for as long as you want, but here you are now, like it's time to sit down and have the meeting.
Man.
Super fun.
You good?
Well, I mean, like, it's kind of one of those things where... Well,
I'll say this real quickly, because I remember I was doing... When I was back in D.C. working local radio, I had a co-host, a buddy of mine, and he used to... He had a thing he called the... He's like, oh, sports are so painful. You got to keep them in the friend zone. And he was trying to make it a bit. And
sure.
He's trying to do this whole thing about, you know, because at the time...
Don't fall in love.
At the time, right, the Nationals had success in the regular season, but it faltered. And you're a Cardinal fan. I was there game 5 of the NLDS in 2012 when they blew a 6-0 lead and squandered that. And it just went on and on until they ultimately won it in 2019. And same for the Capitals. And, you know, the Redskins at the time, now Commanders, were a disastrous franchise. The Wizards continue to be, in my opinion, top 5 most irrelevant franchise in all of sports. So he had this bit, you know, the friend zone. And I just said, you're full of crap, because when one of these teams inevitably wins, in which they did, you're going to be all in on it. And that's the pain of being a fan. And that's why it is fanatical. And You know, I could sense the pain in your voice about the franchise right now, and I'm sure many others echo the same sentiment, but that's what makes being a sports fan. It's part of what's being a sports fan. And, like, to be honest, like, when I think about the run that Alabama had.
Yeah.
Or I remember last year, I don't know if I told you, I might have told you the story on air. My producer last year at VSiN was a Dodger fan, and he texted me and my co-host at the time, Jonathan Von Tobel, the Dodgers are in shambles. So it was like July, and they had a couple guys go on the DL. And I'm like, buddy, you're a Dodger fan.
You want to see how the other half live?
I was like, I get it. My team won a title in 2019, and it was the greatest thing ever. Since then, have not sniffed the playoffs. There is no prospect of making said playoffs. And JVT's an Angel fan. Like, know your audience. And I do this, too, with my buddies up in Wisconsin on my daily radio show there. Well, it's their show. I do the sports with them. Because they would complain about 13-3 seasons and Aaron Rodgers and bowouts in the playoffs. But that's what sports are, man. Like, that's the at the end of the day, only one franchise and one fan base is happy at the end of every season, right? And it sucks right now. And last night was brutal. And who's to say that Thunder fans who are on cloud nine right now aren't going to get kicked right in the fellas next round against the Clippers or in the
conference championship, to your point, last night was the first time that I had to reconsider that maybe they aren't as good as I think. And I get it, it's one game, and you know, part of sports is overreacting. But if the Grizzlies could kind of figure something out, you really think the Clippers can't?
I'll tell you what, man, and Clipper fans, I mean, talk about a beaten and battered fan base. And look, I'm not trying to compare it. Like, I know the pain that
I lived in L.A., Clippers fans are my people, not Lakers fans.
That is, whew, buddy. I mean,
they've seen things.
They've seen some stuff with Kawhi, and even prior to that, obviously. But they looked the part, man. I bet them to win that series against the Nuggets, and I don't want to get prisoner of the moment because obviously they won big last night, and the Thunder, as you alluded to, you know, needed a historic comeback to beat the Grizzlies. That's going to be a war. Assuming the Clippers get out of that series, the best player in the world still plays on the Denver Nuggets. But yeah, but to your point of are sports fun, I think they are. They are. But at the end of the day, we all have days like this where we question our fandom, like, what the hell? Like, what? Why do we do this? And no matter what your team is, you always have these moments of like, why do I do this? Why do I spend my money? But guess what? Not all the time, because I'll say this, in D.C., there was a true mass exodus for a good chunk of time with the worst owner in sports owning the football team. But that's, guess what? They're back, man. They're back because there's hope. And even though they may never win a championship with Jaden Daniels in Washington, that's what sports do. And it's something about it that just makes it, there's this blind like, yeah, that sucked, but I'm going to do it again, you know? And look, after 2012 with the Nationals losing to your Cardinals, I was back there in 14 at playoff games. I was back there in 16. And then I got to witness the wild card comeback in 2019 against the Brewers. I got to go to a bar with my dad in 2017 and spray champagne. Like,
well, you got to beat the cheaters.
It doesn't always happen. But man, when it does happen, this is why I told my co-host at the time, your friend zone theory is such full of BS, because when you're in a relationship, you have so many downtimes, but my God, when the positives come, oh man, there's not much better. Like, I was fortunate to be back on your show the day after Notre Dame Penn State that I got to go to, and I might have as well floated home from Miami back to Vegas.
I think, though, the problem is I'm with you on all of that.
But right now, you can't see that light.
No, I actually think I can even, like, you know, when Rory loses to Bryson at Pinehurst, like, that's, as a sports fan, it's like, not only did my guy lose, the guy that I hate the most won. And so, like, there's that. But, like, I kind of know it's like, he is playing better. Like, there's, you know, there's the chance. What hangs over the Grizzlies right now, if you could tell me, hey, man, they're going to figure out this lease, they're going to stay, and it's going to be good, I think that would be it. But the reality is they're going through what inevitably happens when you have an owner that is not local. Like, in the end, like, I think it's ridiculous. Like, if you look at how American sports works, it operates differently than anywhere else in the world. Like, I mean, just think about when soccer tried to do the Super League in Europe. Like, there's revolts, and all of a sudden, it's done. Case closed. You want to move Everton out? Like, that's, you're not doing that. But, like, in America, it's the same formula every single time. Get the public to subsidize it, and you get the profit. And if you don't like the deal, go take a deal from somewhere else. And from a business perspective, it's like, I get it for Robert Parra. If he could literally double his asset overnight, I mean, most people would probably do that. But it's this looming thing where, you know, I think to a certain degree, you always want the fear of them leaving to be part of a negotiation. Like, that's inevitably, like, I think that's clearly a strategy point. But you can also tell the difference between leverage and, like, reality. And it's still unclear to me. Forever, the idea was, if the NBA is moving to new markets, they were going to do it with expansion because they wanted the expansion fees. Those were higher. But now you're into this situation where you got a better TV deal than you were expected. And if you expand, it's 32 teams cutting into the pie rather than 30. And so now you've got Vegas that's very much, I mean, they've got a plan, basically. They're going to go build, I think, on the south side of the strip, another new arena. And if I'm Robert Parra, like, hey, man, I'm listening. Everyone does the Seattle thing. I still think Seattle has the same problem that they've always had, which is the NBA said if you want back, you have to build a new arena. Well, they said we're not going to do that because they treat sports a little differently. We're going to redo Key Arena, and they have the Kraken, but they don't have the NBA. So is that realistic? Like, I don't know. Mexico City's always thrown out. Are there some cities that maybe make the decision that Memphis made once upon a time, which is, you know what? We want to get into this. Like, does Kansas City do that? Does St. Louis take the money that they got from Kroenke for leaving? Like, do they want to build a new arena for the NBA when they've just redid the Enterprise Center for the Blues? Like, I don't know, but, like, I think that is, we've always had the threat of, like, that was always one of the, when they were pursuing the Grizzlies, one of the jokes was like, who cares? They're just going to leave in 5 years anyway. Well, they've now made roots, and it's now, like, a part of it. And it just feels like, well, here we go again. And, like, that's, you know, that's just kind of the way it works in America. It's like, you know, the owners are unbelievably wealthy. Most of them are not local, and they treat it like an asset, which isn't evil. It's just reality. Because that's, like, in the end, like, maybe the Wizards move to Virginia, maybe the Wizards move to Maryland, but, like, they're still going to be local. You know what I mean?
Right.
I think that's kind of where everyone is. But super fun times. Let's take a break. Let's talk about something even more fun. Blake Topmeyer has had a real cool sit down with Lane Kiffin, and I want to ask him, like, I do actually think the evolution of Lane Kiffin is, it feels kind of like a, I don't know, it's like, what was the movie, Boyhood? Like, it feels like one of those, like, Fox Searchlight movies where it's like a real character story. Like, I want to talk about that with him. Also, he had some comments about the playoff. We'll, of course, talk more about the Nico saga and how Tennessee's standing. We'll do that next, right here on Jeff Wright and Company, 92.9.
Every morning brings a fresh new energy. And no matter what the day holds, we come to the Today Show for all of it.
We get the best start to the day because we start it together.
Watch the Today Show weekdays at 7 a.m. on NBC.
FM, ESPN. Blake Todmeyer is the senior national college football columnist for the USA Today Sports Network. His podcast, SEC Football Unfiltered. New episodes available each week. Serving up his SEC takes alongside, of course, John Adams, wherever you find your podcast, on Twitter, on X, at BTopmeyer. Blake, I'd mentioned it at the end of the last segment. You sat down with Lane Kiffin. You've got two pieces up over at usatoday.com on Lane. I feel like the evolution of Lane Kiffin is one of the more interesting stories that I find myself in sports. Like, I was making the joke, it's almost like a Fox Searchlight movie where it's like a $10 million budget that you saw at the art house film or the art house theater, and it's, you know, about his whole life. Does it all come across as authentic to you?
I think 75-80% comes across as authentic. I think with Lane, there's always an element of mystery, enigma,
brand.
Branding. I mean, he's someone who's incredibly image conscious. I don't think that's a bad thing, right? I think being image conscious can sometimes make you make better decisions. But yeah, I mean, he thinks a lot about that. He thinks a lot about how he's portrayed. And so you do kind of wonder, you know, is this entirely authentic? But I think what is undeniably true is, I think Lane has done a lot of introspection over the last handful of years. I think he's evaluated what is most important to him and what is less important to him. And I do think he really cares about being an active and present dad to his children. I think you can see that in his life, right? I mean, you know, Landry, his oldest daughter, moved to finish her high school.
He moved his ex-wife.
His ex-wife, Layla, is moving to Mississippi this summer officially. And so is Knox. You know, they've kind of been back and forth, you know, as I understand it, in the last several months. But it's becoming official, as Lane told me, this summer. Now, what that means for Lane and Layla, he wouldn't provide more clarity than that. But, yeah, I mean, I do think that element is authentic. I do think what losing his dad meant and how that affected him is authentic. I mean, those two were undeniably close, as not only father, son, but coworkers. I mean, I've been around that Ole Miss facility, and it was not uncommon to see Monty Kiffin strolling the halls and popping in on Lane, and you know, wanted to bend his ear on something. And so that part, again, I don't question any of that either. About what a tough year, you know. I thought that was maybe one of the more interesting parts of the interview. Is yeah, he wanted to talk about his evolution. That was clear. But also, when I asked him about 2024. He called it maybe the hardest year of his life. And I thought that was a really authentic moment. You don't say that lightly. And I think last year really did cut him deep when you combine losing his dad, who was his hero, died last summer. Then he and his girlfriend ended their relationship last fall during their season. He spoke very highly in the interview of his relationship with his ex-girlfriend, but that relationship ended last season. And then, you know, the pain that came with missing the playoff, after all those high expectations. That was interesting and compelling. I thought when he said 2024 was maybe the hardest year of his life, on the heels of 2023, which he considers one of the best years of his life.
I think the other thing that kind of struck me is, because you're right, when he talked about that season, everyone kind of focuses on Florida, but it's like you and I talked about during the fall, it wasn't really the Florida game, man. It was Kentucky. Yeah. And he even includes LSU in that. What did you make of the fact that those are the ones that really seem to haunt him?
Yeah, I thought that was honest and fair, and that's that's one thing that's interesting talking to Lane as compared to a lot of other coaches. You know, a lot of coaches would say like, well, they all stung, you know, they all affected us, blah, blah, blah. No, Lane took the question, which was, you know, does one of these losses sit with you more than others? And he said, not one, but two, the Kentucky and the LSU games, because they led in those games in the fourth quarter and they blew it. And, you know, he was pointing to specific plays in those games, the fourth down opportunities to get defensive stops. Kentucky fumbles, you know, going in for the winning score, recovers their own fumble and scores on a fumble recovery. You know, he remembers specific plays, and I didn't take it really as excuse making, but more as like how close they were to getting one of those two games. And I think he knows whatever complaints he may have, and he had some with the playoff selection process, some which I agree with, some which I don't, but whatever complaints he may have about that playoff process, he knows good and well that that team was one play away in either of those two games from being a playoff team. Because if you beat either Kentucky or LSU, Ole Miss is in the playoff. I really believe that. I mean, that it would have made the committee bounce SMU, but I think the committee would have felt a lot more comfortable doing that with a 10-2.
Yeah, versus 9-3. Yeah,
versus 9-3. Yeah.
What were his big complaints about the playoff?
Well, I think he, like a lot of people in the SEC, believes strength of schedule is not valued enough and record is valued too much. And I guess my rebuttal to that is like, well, where do you draw the line, right? I mean, like Mississippi State played one of the toughest schedules in the country last year, but they stunk. Like, so are we going to rank them in the top 25? You know, like you can schedule a really tough schedule, but you have to go out and win the games. And also, you know, what I would say is like, well, you know, the teams you lost to, I mean, you look at Kentucky was one of the worst teams in the SEC. Not only that, I mean, they'd rank in the bottom 25%, I think, of teams in Power Four football. Kentucky was not good. And Ole Miss lost to them on their home field. Yeah, it was early in the season. I get that. But yeah, I think his biggest complaint were a few. One, he doesn't like that strength of schedule is not valued more. That's number one. Number two, he doesn't think there should be any automatic bids. I don't think he would have a problem with, you know, a Big 12 or a Mountain West team getting in, but he would say that shouldn't be automatic bids. So I said, okay, you're the czar of the playoff. Let's say hypothetical world, Lane Kiffin's the czar. What's your playoff format? And he said 16 teams, all at large. Let a committee decide, you know, incorporate analytics, but go 16 teams and all at large. And I don't necessarily disagree with that. I mean, I'm fine with the format as it is. I think there's a lot of merit to this format, but if it were to change, you know, we've talked about before, I hate the idea of all these auto bids pre-assigned before the season. I mean, going to 16 teams all at large, I don't dislike that idea. You know, I do push back some on the whole strength of schedule thing, because A, I don't think the SEC was as good last year as it's been in some years. And also, it's like, well, you lost at home to Kentucky. So that has to matter to some degree, I think. And so that's kind of where it stood.
Blake Topmeyer joining us here on the program. Blake, speaking of Ole Miss, their quarterback, their former quarterback, now headed to the New York Giants. I have actually asked Jeffrey about how he's feeling on this. Maybe we can find out a little bit later. We had a whole 30-minute segment on sports aren't
last
fun.
Last night was an emotional night for your boy.
But,
oh, really?
Lot was going on.
But, Blake, when you talk to Lane and when you talk to people, you know, around the program, what are they – expect from Jackson Dart? And I know that Brian Daboll and the Giants did a lot of due diligence. Joe Shane, I believe, what, his daughter goes to Ole Miss?
I know his son. Peter Schrager said his son goes to Ole Miss. And then I heard other people saying, well, no, his daughter. I don't know if maybe
child
both.
Goes to Ole yes. Miss. How about we'll leave it at that. And Charlie Weiss Jr., we know that there's a relationship with his dad and Brian Daboll. So they had a lot of intel on Jackson
Dart.
Well,
and I think Brian and Lane.
Well, and Joe Judge are still, obviously.
Well, and I think Brian and Lane, I think they've been on a staff together.
So what?
Yeah,
what
I think
did
that
you...
might be right. Yeah. I mean, the thing for Jackson Dart is consistency, right? I mean, there were games, usually against the more inferior opponents, where he looked like an All-American. He looked like an All-Star. And then some of the bigger moments, I thought he receded a little bit. And he got better at that as his career went along. You know, he delivered the win against Georgia with the help of some defense, but
and Tordahl.
Pardon me?
And Tordahl.
Yeah. Yeah. But look, I mean, we've seen when he plays well, he's got a lot of ability, but I do kind of question, you know, where was he in some of the biggest games of his career? You know, interceptions, that's something he's got to be mindful of, I think, in the NFL. You know, Lane's system, not unlike Tennessee's system, puts quarterbacks in position to succeed, particularly quarterbacks that can also run, which Jackson Dart can. You know, how much he'll be doing that in the NFL, I don't know. I mean, I think I saw in an interview that he really admires Jalen Hurts. I mean, that would be the ideal, right, if he can. But Jalen Hurts is an incredible decision maker in the NFL, and I think that's where Jackson Dart will have to grow at the next level, because you know, I don't think he's going to have some of the advantages of playing in Lane's offense, you know, in the NFL. That's not a system that is run in the NFL, and I do think that helps quarterbacks. With the pace, it puts defenses on their heels. I think it makes it simplifies decisions a little bit for quarterbacks, particularly once they know the system. So I think there's, you know, there's some upside with him, but I think there's also a lot of question marks. I think with a lot of quarterbacks that come out of that system, frankly, and I don't think that's a bad thing, for Ole Miss. I mean, their offense has ranked near or at the top of the conference every year Kiffin's been the coach there. But I do think, like, there's still sort of a waiting to see it in the NFL, and who knows, maybe Jackson Dart will be the guy.
No, I'm with you. The hardest part about Jackson as a prospect is the offense is so different. Like, even in the NFL where they've started implementing RPOs, this is a completely different thing. You're not putting wide receivers at the sideline in the NFL.
No.
And there's hash mark things, like, to not get into the nitty-gritty, but I think it's a fair assessment. It's like, I didn't feel like any of these guys in this draft were like, I would be, if I were in the scouting room, I'd pound the table of like, I believe in this guy. I didn't feel really strongly about any of them.
I totally agree. It feels
to me like that what they are banking on is they believe in Jackson Dart the person, and so they're going to go try it that way. But I mean, basically my overall feeling is like, what's the word? Like, I'm going to have to sit through a half a season of Russell Wilson. Like, give me something else. Like, I'm fine.
Yeah. No, I think Jackson Dart, the person, if you're looking for, like, the positive traits, I mean, that's an upside for him. And I think you hit it well there. Like, I mean, this is someone where I think NFL evaluators like the demeanor of Jackson Dart. I mean, Ole Miss benefited from his demeanor. But, yeah, I mean, when Jackson Dart was at his best, frankly, was like when he was running it 20 times a game, right? I mean, he was a really dynamic runner, tough guy, could gain the hard yards, but also, you know, wasn't bad in open space either. You know, how much of that is he going to be doing in the NFL? Again, the whole Jalen Hurts comparisons, I don't know if I totally see that. I think Jackson Dart was a very, very good college quarterback. I guess I'll kind of be in the believe it when I see it mode as far as it comes for the NFL. But I agree with you, like the quarterback class as a whole, it's not like I liked, you know, a ton of other guys that were on the board better. I think this was a weak class for quarterbacks. I called it a fat guy draft. Like, I think in a lot of ways we could say this was a down draft. And then skill positions, I think it was a little bit. Like, as far as the fat guys go, I think it was a pretty good draft. Like, offensive and defensive line, I think there was some real talent coming out this year. But that's, you know, that's not the flash that we're often looking for in round one and two in the NFL draft. You know, a lot of the focus goes on wide receivers, quarterbacks, pass rushers, those types of things. But I really felt like this was more of a fat guy draft, interior lineman, offensive lineman type of draft.
Yeah, I think that's more than fair.
Yeah, I kind of felt like I did a radio hit before the draft in Baltimore yesterday, and I'm like, you know what? I feel like the back end of this draft, like the Baltimore Ravens, the Bills, the Eagles
Chiefs, freaking did it again.
God, like they're all going to get a guy who's going to start, and it's not sexy, right? Like Malachi Starks, I think, massively improved the Baltimore Ravens secondary. Now you've got Kyle Hamilton and Starks back there. Like, I have a feeling that Josh Simmons is going to be an 8-10 year starter for the Kansas City Chiefs.
It's so happy for them.
Yeah, it feels like there were stretches maybe up top, but then at the bottom where the good teams were, they're like, oh, I'll happily take a 6-8 year starter. Thank you very much. Who will just plug and play in our 12-win franchise. Blake, I want to shift a little bit. We talked a couple weeks ago. I think we did the rankings on the show, just quarterbacks coming into this year. And since you talked to Lane, there's so much fascination, at least for me, on quarterback play this year in college football, so much intrigue. What's the feel out of Oxford right now with Austin Simmons?
I think Lane's pretty comfortable with him. As he put it, good arm, very high ceiling. I mean, Lane is not one. Lane would rather take this for what you will. He'd rather spend 90% of the interview talking about himself and looking inward than talking about his roster. And part of that, I think, is to kind of keep the pressure off his guys and not set unreasonable expectations. I also think Lane just sort of enjoys looking inward. But yes, when the conversation did turn to Austin Simmons, I think you can tell, like, he likes what he's got there. And I think Lane really likes what he has on his offense. I think where the question lies is, I think he knows that defense last year, which was the best defense Ole Miss has seen in, well, gosh, quite some time. He finally had the defense.
14, they were good on defense. I covered that team.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
But
yeah,
other than we are talking about a school that historically they would rather, if they got a good player, they want him on offense.
Yeah, and even 14, and we were talking about a decade ago,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
So he and that's where I think he knows it was an opportunity missed last year, because he had the defense. They'd invested through NIL and the portal into getting some real studs on that defense, and it stepped up, like in that Georgia game, right? I mean, Ole Miss had the better defense in that game, and that's saying something. I think, he didn't quite put it in these words, but I think he's concerned about whether that defense can maintain the level of play this year. He's still got some good guys over there, but I don't think he has the depth of talent on defense that he had last year, and I don't think he maybe has as many stars on the defense as he had last year. A lot of turnover on offense, a lot of new faces, new starters, but I think he believes that they're still in good shape at quarterback. I think he thinks, even though there's a lot of turnover at wide receiver, I think he thinks they're still in good shape at the skill positions. Got to see it in action. But I would say, his comfortability with the offense is more advanced than what he feels about his defense right now, I think.
All right, switching gears to kind of wrap up. How much faith do you have that these schools are going to go back with the house settlement? They've basically been told you're going to have to either grandfather in the roster limits or you're going to have to remove this. How much trust do you have that that's actually going to get accomplished here in the next, 11 days now?
60-40, maybe. 60-40 saying that they change and that they, they make this change that the federal judge wants. I mean, I don't get it. I mean, I saw a quote from a Ross Dellinger story at Yahoo Sports. They're playing chicken with a federal judge, and it's just like, well, who do you think's going to win that one, right? Like, I know who I'm betting on too. I think I'm backing the federal judge there. And if you thumb your nose at her, I really think that's choose your steps wisely there, right? Because I think she's going to react in kind. I mean, she's shown her hand at every phase. Like, she wants to approve the settlement, but the thing she keeps asking for is grandfather in, these roster limits things. So you're not leaving guys out there twisting in the wind. And I think, I mean, coaches would be fine with that, right? I mean, they're complaining anyway of, oh my gosh, how are we going to get through a season with only 105 guys, which sounds a little ridiculous to me, but whatever. I mean, so coaches would be on board with this. It's the ADs and the presidents that are thinking, we got expenses piling up over in these corners. We need to find some cost savings in these other areas, and shrinking your roster sizes would be one way to save a few pennies, right? But yeah, I don't know. I mean, like I said, it seems like the judge has shown her hand. She wants to approve this, but you got to grandfather in the people that are on rosters now when it comes to these roster limits. And man, it would be really something if they kind of blew, after all this, if they blew up this settlement over that. I'm not saying it's an inconsequential.